This is the PropTech VC Podcast. We give you unique insights into how innovative technologies are disrupting real estate. We interview top entrepreneurs, investors, and knowledgeable experts to share the inside scoop in this fast-moving industry. It's hosted by leading PropTech VC, Zane Jaffer. Let's dive into today's content.
Today, we're here with Nathan Marr, the founder and CEO of Mero, an analytics platform focused on properties in the commercial cleaning and supply market. Nathan, welcome. So tell us your story. How did you end up here as an entrepreneur?
First off, thanks for having me, Zane. I think what's led me to this point really is just natural entrepreneurship in my blood. I think it's really something that is intrinsic in a lot of people. Ever since I was at a young age, I was always starting new things, new clubs or new ways of people to get together. My family's entrepreneurs. They come from a long history of entrepreneurship. My grandfather actually moved from China when I was when he's in the 50s, 1950s, and he started a retail store in Red Deer, Alberta, in Canada. That kind of led to growing sort of real estate business and more. And he just continued to add on to it into our family legacy, you could say. So that kind of led me to really having that sort of entrepreneurship bone in my life. And I obviously had been exposed a lot to commercial real estate prior to all of this. So Mero was kind of just a culmination of all of that. I met a really strong technical partner, and that was kind of the rest of it.
Nathan, growing up in a Chinese family, what type of values did that espouse in you? And do you think that had an impact on where you ended up as an entrepreneur? Was there a focus on education? Like, I came from an Indian family, and you know, some of our viewers might appreciate this, but Indian parents are quite strict. And everyone wants their child to be like a doctor or a dentist. And in my case, I was the misfit. You know, I loved tinkering around with computers, and I went against the status quo. Certainly didn't come, I would say, from a family with an entrepreneurial background. Although Indians are known for that, it wasn't the case in my family. Was there pressure on you to go down a different path, or was it always clear that, you know, you're an entrepreneurial family and this is sort of in your DNA?
Yeah, so I'm the younger of two brothers. Fortunately enough for me, my brother kind of paved the way in sort of that security blanket and kind of laid that over the family. He's a dentist and a practicing dentist, and he has a couple of practices in Alberta. So that really kind of gave me full rein and the security to know that I could kind of venture out and do something on my own. So when I went to business school and started kind of just playing around with ideas and like I mentioned, really working with a lot of the engineering side. My background's in both business and science, so I did a major in science and a minor in business. So I was able to really connect, and I think that slightly technical background of science gave me at least an understanding of what really could bring into the future. So I think everybody's experiences and, you know, what's they're kind of intrinsically given lead them into building, you know, kind of their futures. And I think that's really the case with me. But I really do think that, yeah, Chinese families, typically the impetus is to just, you know, chase security and not until you've really cut your teeth and been out in the world a little bit should you take big risks. But, you know, fortunately for me, I was instilled pretty early that I could take that jump and make that leap, which I think a lot of other first generation Chinese kids are really given.
Did you have any role models when it came to the real estate sector within your family, or was it more just people were running operational businesses rather than real estate investments?
Yeah, so my family is very, they show up to work every day and they put in their 110% effort, and that's kind of all they've known. But I really kind of saw, maybe even young, that there's a lot of inefficiency within that. You know, they're working every day from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., even working Saturdays. And, you know, that's just the way it was. They just show up for work and they get it done. But I wasn't seeing a lot of growth beyond that. My grandfather, when he moved to Red Deer, it was a city the size of maybe 20,000 people, and it grew to about 120,000 today. And obviously with that comes, you know, growth in real estate and growth in investments. So he made some smaller real estate investments, things like commercial malls, strip malls, small things like that, and just continued to sort of grow it and expand it slowly by slowly. And I think that exposure and that kind of exposure to seeing and appreciating and growing asset like real estate really gave me an understanding of how, you know, investment into something early on, investing into the operation and keeping it a strong asset, and then eventually trying to grow that into something else was really a lucrative path. So they're very operations driven, you know, not so much on the growth mindset, and I hope to kind of bring some of that growth mindset back into the family eventually one day.
Got it. So Nathan, what's going on right now? You know, we're on the path to mass vaccination, and what's the state of things in your customer base and also regionally where you operate?
Yeah, so obviously as a prop tech founder, March came and it was a big shock to the entire world. You know, first priority was obviously to take care of the team and take care of everybody that helps us on building our mission. So we're really focused on trying to help the cleaning and hygiene vertical within commercial properties. The first wave of COVID was completely shut down, obviously, and kind of react to try to, you know, put in emergency measures into place. But we found that the second wave was really about putting in some of these, you know, higher cleaning standards and things like that. And that really, to our fortune, really fell into line with what we were doing.
So you started the company prior to COVID. Then what was your reaction when COVID happened? Did you think it would be game over for you guys because of, you know, the nascent stage you were at? Or did you quickly realize, actually, you know, this could be an opportunity for us? Or were you afraid, you know, initially?
Yeah, I think it would be sort of remiss to not mention a little bit of fear. Nobody knew, you know, what was going on at all in March. But we were fortunate in a lot of ways to have enough runway to get us through, you know, a good year and a half once March hit. So the timing of things like fundraises and stuff like that, that's the 50% of luck that I think comes into play when you embark on entrepreneurship. So we wrapped up a fundraise in February 2020.
Wow.
So we can, yeah.
So COVID obviously was on the scene in February, right? But you had started your fundraising way before that, I assume, because people know, you know, it's very hard and you read headlines that, you know, certain company raised a boatload of money. The reality is it takes months and months and often, you know, years of building relationships with potential investors. In your case, how quickly did your round come together?
Yeah, we definitely had that sort of, you know, typical fundraising experience I think any first-time founder would. You know, obviously being in the industry that we are, we came up on some friction, especially early on. But we really started working on this business since about 2018. You know, I met my co-founder in 2017. You know, we started putting ideas together, but it really didn't start to formulate until 2018. And it wasn't until late 2019 until we really started generating our first customers. And I think that's kind of the first proof of validation that any founder needs in order to start building the narrative for a fundraise. So it really kind of started formulating our pitch in late 2019. And we didn't start getting capital commitments until the end of 2020, pardon me. So it really takes that amount of time, I think, for you to be able to communicate an early stage pitch and understand your customer enough so that you can communicate it to a potential investor about how it could grow from there.
So timing worked out very well for you guys. Easily you could have decided to postpone fundraising a quarter before COVID hit, and then you would have been in a bad situation. Good businesses and bad businesses were impacted in COVID, and it came down to money. A lot of people who were in the midst of fundraising had term sheets pulled because investors just couldn't. They put a pause on investing. You know, they had to reevaluate what's going on in the marketplace. And a lot of companies who were in areas like office and retail, and I mean the bad side of it, right? You're on the good side of it. Or on the good side of it, I mean, as a company, you're dealing with all the tailwinds in your favor, with cleaning being so important. So it's an accelerator for you. But many companies were involved in areas in these sectors where they were hit pretty bad. And they raised funding, some of them, and they were lucky because now they had time to pivot, they had time to go after new verticals. Others, though, didn't, and they were dead. And then you had good companies that didn't have funding either and weren't able to get funding, which this is the time when the market shifts. You need to double down and take advantage of the opportunity. So it definitely worked out well for you guys. Now let's talk a bit about the importance of cleanliness overall. Is this a fad? Is this hot right now because everyone has to abide by the new regulations and cleaning to reopen? And will this, die down eventually? Or do you see this being a permanent shift, the focus on cleanliness and tracking things?
Yeah, so I really think it's a mixture of both. On the one hand, I think humans, by nature, we're creatures of habit, and I think we'll naturally fall back into what we knew as a routine once. But that's not to say that it's going to go fully back to that case. There's some comforts that we really began to enjoy, but we're probably not going to be able to embrace again, even once everybody's vaccinated and once this pandemic is under control. And one of those things we think is the nature of the standard office as we know it. The standard office experience of people packing in like sardines into a space and packing the subway so that they can all get to the same place at the same time and clock in at the same time, I think is going out the wayside now that people have adjusted to this more flexible working arrangement. But that's not to say that companies are not going to be getting a major competitive advantage by having people all, or at least a group of people, in the same space. And I think people are starting to realize the downsides of being completely remote these days. Speaking for ourselves, we have a hardware component. We've definitely felt some of the pressures of being completely remote. We're doing a lot of things just to try to bridge the gaps in communications and things like that. But I think that's one of the things that good leaders are going to help navigate through is really what are the cards that you're dealt with and how are you going to navigate? And like you said, how can you pivot to make the most of the situation?
So, what do you sort of see as an entrepreneur right now, the downside to your operations being remote? Some companies are pledging they're going to be remote forever and have realized tremendous cost savings, and that's their DNA. You've got companies like Twitter and Google and Facebook who are, for the time being, for a significant time, are going to be remote, and some indefinitely too. How has it impacted you as a startup? Most startups I know, by the way, are completely embracing remote, but you have a hardware component, so what's the impact for you being remote?
Yeah, I think there's that just that component of I think knowledge transfer, which can take a little bit longer, which isn't in person. And part of that is just being in a startup where a lot of the knowledge transfer comes from the founders in the first place, I think. Once you're at a scale of Shopify or Google, it's much, much easier to say, we can go fully remote because the whole playbook's written. Obviously there's some instances where it's not the case, but for the most part, they're at the scale which their size precludes them from having to really be in person anymore because the contributors are able to do so from many different locations. I think as we scale, we'd like to be more of the approach to be less reliant on being in person. It's probably going to be a flex model. We're going to have part of the people in when they have to be, and everybody else is going to be remote first. And I think that's the approach that smart companies are taking, not fully in on one or the other, and just being a little bit more flexible. And I think that's the trend overall in commercial real estate as we see our customers, tenants are starting to prepare for that nature of that flexible work arrangement, sending part of the workforce into the office, and even finding things like subleases or hoteling type situations for other tenants to come and share that space. Those are creative ways that we're hearing about commercial offices getting their spaces used.
It's interesting about there's a lot of conflicting data out there. You look at some reports And they're showing a clear decline in the leasing rates, and they're showing a lot of downsizing going on. But then, other reports are showing people are fed up of being in a remote place, and they're calling it Zoom fatigue. I think it comes down to obviously the type of setup you have. If you're living in a cramped studio, it's not, and you've got children or whatever, right? You're just not set up really to deal with remote work. Whereas if you've got the luxury of a nice home with a private office, it's very different. So it has an impact there. I'm hearing firsthand from companies that there are some things that can never be done remote, and it just doesn't compare to being in person. And we're talking about key operations here. We're talking about things like how you onboard employees, how you provide mentoring and training and development, even the social camaraderie. None of that can be replicated through an online remote environment.
That's right. Yeah. And that's the thing is that all of the arguments to be in the office are more of the kind of soft benefits or maybe psychological benefits, but all of the objective logical reasoning it says to work remote. So it's this bit of a the two sides of your brain are sort of fighting at one another in order to do so. I in lieu of sounding traditional or whatnot, I do agree with you. I think there's just some things that can't be replaced doing in person.
I think what's important to note on is that there is a reversal of the densification trend. I think you pointed out people are packed into offices like sardines. Over time, we've seen the number of desks in an office increase, and I think we're going to see a reversal of that trend where public or common areas and amenities are going to be more important. You're trying to convince your employees to brave the commute and separate from their families and the routine and the luxury of being able to, go out in nature to come into an office, and that's a tall order. So you have to reconfigure things.